Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. Before we begin our conversation, I'll remind you to join WEAA's Big Jim and your other favorite hosts here at WEAA for our second annual WEAA Morgan State University Homecoming Dinner Cruise aboard the Spirit of Baltimore Thursday, October 21st from 7 to 10 p.m. Sailing from the historic Inner Harbor, it'll be a night of oldies, blues, and more, dancing, live entertainment, games, full dinner buffet, and much more, so don't miss the boat. For tickets, 1-800-695-BOAT. That's 1-800-695-BOAT, or go to weaa.org. We're joined in studio this hour by Greg Bernstein, who is running to become the next Baltimore City State's attorney. He is a partner in the law firm of Zuckerman Spader, LLP. He's been a federal prosecutor. We were trying to make this into a debate between Greg Bernstein and State's Attorney Pat Jessamy. She couldn't make today. She's going to be on the show Monday. And Anthony McCarthy and I are in active conversations with campaigns to have both of them reappear with Anthony, with the two of us, either on his show or my show or an independent time, to have a debate before all the listeners here in the WEA audience. But right now, we invite you to join us here at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888, as we have a conversation with Greg Bernstein, who is running to replace Pat Jessamy as state's attorney. And Greg, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Let me do something I've never do, but I apparently have done today, which is to leave my cell phone on. Let's turn it off. Sorry.
You know, when you do that in court, Mark, you get a lot of trouble.
You do. When you do it on my show, you get into a lot of trouble. And I've just got myself into trouble. So there we are. So, well, welcome. Good to have you with us, Greg. And folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. This has grown into a fairly contentious race, I would say. And people are seeing it on some levels on another show you were on, other appearances you've had, where the two of you kind of barely look at one another, and it's, people look at it in a very personal way, like this is some personal animus between the two. How do you respond to that?
Well, I couldn't disagree more.
Okay.
I don't think it's contentious, and I think it's been a bit overblown by the press about the supposed, to use your word, animus that existed between us last week on the other radio station that'll go nameless. Your producers will be pleased about that. Frankly, I've known Ms. Jessamy for a long time, not well, but certainly know her. I've come across her, and we've always had a cordial relationship. I have a lot of respect for her. I think she's done a lot of great things in the community on a personal level. And I've said that to many, many audiences that I've appeared before during, you know, this campaign. My objection and the reason that I'm running is because of the lack of effectiveness in the way that she's run the state's attorney's office. But it's certainly, it's not personal from my end. I mean, I know that, you know, she said some not nice things to me during the debate, but I don't take that personally, and I think that the press overblew the idea that we weren't looking at each other. I mean, we were in a crowded, you know, studio and a radio station. So, no, I don't view that at all.
Well, I let me just say that and I'm not going to spend time on this, because I think that one of the things the press hasn't done, except in a few cases, very few cases here, which I would like to try to get to here in the course of this hour with you, and with the listeners calling in at 410-319-8888, and Dan, you're the first caller from Pigtown, we'll come to you in a minute, is to try to get to something substantive. Right now, it's been all politics and personality. At least it feels that way, that it's been politics and personality. And I think that one of the things that people want to kind of figure out how to discern here is, what's the distance between you two in terms of what you would do as state's attorney? I mean, why would you even want in the first place to run to replace Pat Jessamy, who's been at that job for a long time?
Right. Let me answer that question first. And the answer is that as a lifelong resident of Baltimore and one who has practiced here in the city for my entire professional career, I have watched for the last 15 years as I have seen the quality of the effectiveness and the presentations by the state's attorney's office just steadily decrease. And this inability to prosecute and convict the most violent offenders who go through this revolving door of committing violent crimes and then they're right back on the street, coupled with this inability of Ms. Jessamy to get work cooperatively with law enforcement, which I think is a huge detriment to the ability of the state's attorney's office to be effective. So when you talk about an answer to your question about what our differences are, I think they're pretty significant, because I think that where the state's attorney's office has failed is that it has not used its resources in a strategic, effective manner to convict the most violent felonies. Baltimore remains one of the most dangerous cities in the country to live in. It still does. It has for the last 15 years. And finally, I just decided that enough was enough, and I was going to take a shot and step up and see if I could do a better job.
So as someone who spent time as a federal prosecutor, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And as a defense attorney?
That is correct.
So how would you do things substantially different? In other words, I know a lot of assistant DAs who go off there and do the best they can, at least my perception, in court to defend the citizens of the city and to prosecute people who commit violent crimes or crimes against people. And they win and sometimes they don't. We'll talk about the study that was raised, that you raised by the Able Foundation, and come to that in a minute. But I'm curious, you're not going to fire every state's attorney that works there. So what? Let's say you become state's attorney. So what do you do on your first day at work? What do you do to go directly to the issue of how cases are tried?
Well, here's what I would do on my first day of work. I would come to work, and I would be in the courthouse with the assistant state's attorneys who are trying the cases, something that Ms. Jessamy has not done for 15 years.
Why would you do that?
Because I think that it is vitally important for the effectiveness of the office, for the assistant state's attorneys that work under you, to know that you are there watching them, helping them try cases, giving them advice, putting them in the best position to be the most effective. Ms. Jessamy has not been in a courtroom in 15 years. She's not tried a case. She's not second chaired a case. She's not been in a courtroom to watch her assistants try cases.
Now, how do you know that third statement's true?
It's a fact. I mean, I've said it repeatedly. She's never denied it. She's never disputed it. I have absolutely no evidence to believe that she's ever been in a courtroom ever watching her assistants. No one's ever told me they've ever seen her in a courtroom. So if she's got other evidence to suggest that she has been, I'd like to hear about it. But I've been saying this since I first announced, and she's never disputed that fact. I mean, what she says, in fairness to her, is that, the job of the state's attorney is broader than being in a courtroom, and you can't spend all your time in a courtroom trying cases. And I respect that. I think that's correct. I mean, there's a lot of things that you have to do as state's attorney. But I do think that a big part of it is being in the courthouse, is being with your assistants, because how else do you know how they're doing? I mean, when you talk about, when you make, broad statements about my state's attorneys are working really hard and we're being really effective, I mean, really, at the end of the day, how do you know if you're not there? So when you ask me, what am I going to do the first day, that's what I'm going to do the first day. The second thing I'm going to do is I'm going to conduct an audit of the entire office. I want to see how resources are being applied, because I do not believe that they are being applied in an effective manner in order to target these most violent offenders, which I think should be, at least initially, the focus of the office. I think the training in the state's attorney's office is frankly abysmal. The young assistants get little, if any. They certainly don't get any kind of peer review or work with more senior state's attorneys. They don't do second chairs and try cases together. And I think that that's where you've got to start. So, no, I'm not going to go in there the first day and fire everybody. That's not the way. I mean, morale in the state's attorney's office is pretty low as it is. If you go in and fire everybody, I mean, you're just going to make things worse. But I think if you give the assistant state's attorneys the tools that they need to be more effective in the courtroom in their presentations, they're going to do a better job.
Let me talk about, and we'll open the phones in a few minutes, folks. Dan and Hank, the first two callers up at 410-319-8888, as we talk with Greg Bernstein, the Baltimore City State's Attorney candidate, running in the primary against Pat Jessamy. When we talk about the low conviction rate, or people allege is a low conviction rate, and people always kind of cite the 2008 Able Foundation study, which I know very well because I've read it number of times, and we did shows about this, about the study itself. I mean, one of the things the study said very clearly is they're talking about all kinds of reasons besides what Pat Jessamy and her state's attorneys do as to why there are fewer convictions in the city of Baltimore. That, A, we live in a city where many working class and poor residents do not trust the police, do not trust the court system, and have had their own issues with the court system and police that have been less than honest and good for them. And that is a big difference why you see that 23% rate in the cases they looked at as opposed to the other rates that are high in other counties. And quite frankly, Ray, let me throw this out to you, and you can comment on all this, which is in other counties, Baltimore County, Howard County, a lot of the conviction rates, and I've only seen people allege this, and I don't know it to be true, okay? But that the majority of jurors are white, and many of the people convicted are black, and that race plays a role in those convictions as much as race may play a role the other way in convictions here in Baltimore. So the issues are beyond just what the prosecutor does. And so are we kind of painting this broad brush for these prosecutors in Baltimore without looking at the broader picture?
Well, I think what the Able Foundation study found, which is, to me, pretty clear, is that conducting the analysis that they did and looking at all the factors, they found that the seriousness of the offense and the nature of the offender, that is to say his prior criminal record, has the greatest impact on the conviction rate. And that's why the Able Foundation study found that there was a great disparity between conviction rates in Baltimore and the surrounding counties. And so what they found was that, as you point out, that the conviction rate in Baltimore City was the lowest by far for serious offenses among the other counties that they studied. And so what the Able Foundation study concluded was that there are just a whole host of other factors that have to be further studied and considered. Not that the ones that you've identified as being the cause, but that it needs to be further studied and considered. And what I would say to that is further, Mark, is that I do not accept the notion that Baltimore City juries are not able to intelligently evaluate the evidence and reach a just verdict based on that evidence. I think that the problem has been with the manner in which the cases are presented. And when I talk to people all over the city, people that have sat on juries, people that have been involved in the court system, what I hear repeatedly is that the presentation, the manner in which the cases are presented, is what in most cases causes the not guilty verdicts. Now, I'm not saying that there certainly are not going to be cases, and I know this because I'm a trial lawyer. I try cases my whole career, that there will be cases where there will be jury nullification. But I would submit to you that percentage, based on the kind of factors that you've talked about, is much, much lower than what people think. And I think that if you do a better job of working with police, of preparing witnesses, of not talking to officers on the morning of trial, of calling up witnesses on the night before. I mean, if you do the kind of things that you need to do to prepare your case in an effective manner, you're going to start to see a better rise in the conviction rates.
Well, and then we'll open the phone to this question, folks. Dan, Hank, Leo, the first going in that order. Is Baltimore is one of the few major jurisdictions in the country where the police do the charging? New York City, other major districts, the DA does the charging, the state's attorney does the charging. Now, there are several questions in that realm I want to ask, but let me just start with this A part of it, and we get to the B after my callers come in. The A part is, that's something that people have argued should have changed a long time ago, that Pat Jessamy argued that should change a long time ago, that every police commissioner has opposed. And I want to hear your position on that. I mean, it seems to me that part of the problem in some of the court cases is part of the problem, not all the problem. Part of the problem is that the charging mechanism in the city is flawed, that police often make bad charges that can't stick, that they're not thought through the way a lawyer, a state's attorney, would think it through. Do you think that has to change?
Well, I think that to the extent that system may or may not be flawed does not at all apply to the kind of cases that I'm talking about that we need to be more focused on. Because it's my belief that the reason why we are in a crisis in this city and have been for the last 15 years regarding the violence in the streets and the repeated violent felonies that are committed by the same people over and over again is because of an inability of the state's attorney's office to work cooperatively with the police department. Because what I'm talking about, Mark, is not locking up thousands of people. That's not what this is about at all. You can't do that. They tried that 10 years ago. I mean, it doesn't work. What I'm talking about is we know who the 500 or 600 bad guys are out there. I mean, we know that based on their records and their prior criminal history. And so when they get arrested on a new charge, then that's when you start to be strategic by working at the early stages with the police and the state's attorney's office to make sure that you're presenting that case in a way that you're going to get the conviction. And if you do that in those cases, you're not going to have an issue about who's making the charging decisions or not, because you're now working together in terms of coming up jointly with a decision about when to charge and what to charge. The other cases, the more routine ones, for lack of a better way to describe it, you know, there's so many, I'd have to think further about whether, you know, the police should still charge those cases or not. But that's not really the problem with the system. The problem with the system is that in part, that the state's attorney's office has just not been effective in prosecuting these more violent offenders.
Well, I have more questions about that, but I promise the listeners I'll let them in. Greg Bernstein is our guest. Greg Bernstein, of course, is an attorney here in Baltimore with Zuckerman Spader, LLP. He's been a former federal prosecutor. He is challenging Pat Chesney to become the next city state's attorney here in Baltimore City. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join in the conversation. Dan in Pigtown, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me on. I'm
Thanks
the president of the Community Association, the Pigtown Community Association. The biggest problem we have is the state's attorney's office dropping charges, and I have to vehemently disagree with you, Mark. The police are arresting the right people. They're charging them with the right crimes over and over and over again. And we as a community association sit there and watch as Pat Chesney, state's attorney's office, drops charges constantly and just sends these guys right back out on the street to deal their drugs, or if they're prostitutes, to continue fueling the drug trade, being prostitutes. And it's causing all kinds of havoc on our community. Prostitutes about a year ago went into vacant houses. They were burning them down. These are people that should be in jail. They should be prosecuted for what the police are charging them. The police are not the problem. It's the state's attorney's office.
And is there a question there besides a statement?
The question is, for Mr. Bernstein, would you more aggressively go after drug dealers and prostitutes? Would you drop as many charges as Pat Chesney is doing?
Well, Dan, you know, of course, it's hard to, you know, speak in generalities, but what I would say is that, I mean, I certainly agree with a lot of what you said to a certain extent. And I think that once you have a more cooperative working relationship with the police department, I think you'll see less and less cases being dropped and more cases being pursued, because, you know, you can't, it's hard enough to fight crime as it is. But when you're engaged in a system where every time something goes wrong, the state's attorney's spokesperson is in front of the TV camera saying it's not our fault, it's the police fault, they didn't do a good job investigating, you're not going to instill confidence in the police department and a willingness to work with them. And I think once you start doing that, the cases that Dan's referring to don't get dropped and they're pursued.
One of the things that Dan was talking about was what happens when you arrest somebody, let's say for what he was describing, prostitution. Now, I'll just throw it, and Dan may disagree with this as well, but that's okay.
That's why they call it talk radio.
That's why they call it radio. Well, we all have ideas, and but this is a place where we can do it civilly and actually have a conversation about it. All the prostitutes I've known who are in rehab and places people I've interviewed.
Did you say prosecutors or prostitutes?
Prostitutes.
Oh, okay. Just
and
to
prosecutors
sure.
as well. I've known. They're not in the same breath, but I've known them. But that are mostly substance abusers. There's a huge argument. What do you do? What does it do to prosecute a woman for prostitution who has a heroin addiction or whatever she has, or she's trying to feed her child and she's got alcohol assistance, whatever the issue is she's facing, and prosecute her and putting her in prison? What have we done there? We clean the streets up for 5 seconds until someone else takes her place. We don't go after the Johns. We don't go after some of the men that use and abuse the women who ply this trade on our streets. So is that what we're going to do, start locking up dozens and dozens more women who are arrested for prostitution and put them in prison? Is that the solution?
Well, right. I mean, that to answer your question directly, it doesn't do much, if anything. And as I mentioned earlier, my philosophy, my strategy is not to lock up hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, I find it a little ironic that in the beginning of this campaign, for example, that Ms. Jessamy was quoted as saying several times that, you know, if I lock up 1,000 people, there'll be 1,000 more people to take their place. Kind of the argument being, I can't lock up everybody. I guess that's what she's trying to say. But now to support her record as a state's attorney, she's relying on commitment records of people that are just committed to the correctional system without any kind of deviation or distinction about who these people are, what crimes they've been committed and the like. And certainly in the examples that you're giving, Mark, you know, with the prostitute who's a drug addict, you've got to, if those individuals don't have a violent history and do not show that they're going to be repeat offenders, then you certainly want to try for alternative programs and ways in which they can get help. But, of course, there are other agencies that are set up to do that. It's not the state's attorney's job to set up these alternative programs. But as state's attorney, if I have cases involving prostitutes, using the examples that you're giving to me, and they don't have a violent history, don't have multiple arrests, and Mark, you come to me and say, I have a program that's designed, I'm willing to try that, of course.
So what do you do differently, and then Hank, Leo, Victor, coming. What do you do differently in this war room that we keep debating about?
Well, here's what I would do differently.
Describe what the war room is.
Yes, no problem. The war room is a group or part of the state's attorney's office that was set up with a grant from the governor's office, and its purpose was to track the most violent offenders who are repeat offenders, who are on parole and probation for whatever, you know, various offenses, and who then get arrested again, and to make sure that they either had a high bail or a low bail, I mean, or no bail, excuse me, high bail or no bail, and then to track their cases through the system to make sure both that they were convicted of the new charge, and second, to make sure that their probation violation hearing resulted in a finding of guilt and additional time. Now, there's someone that did an independent study, got a grant, analyzed the case.
Page Corder and the
Abel Foundation didn't do it.
They paid Page Corder to do it.
And she ran the war room at one time, so you would think she'd be somebody that have some knowledge of how the system works. And what she found was, in her study, that the conviction rate for the war room offenders, and these are the worst of the worst, is 35%. Now, to me, that is unacceptable because these are the very types of offenders that I'm talking about that go through this revolving door that we need to prosecute. And the conviction rate for the violation of probation hearings for these individuals is 35%. Now, you ask me, Mark, what would I do differently?
Right.
Well, what I would do differently is what the state's attorney's office is not doing, which is to actually track the cases through. Because if you've read the report and some of the other things that Ms. Kreuter has written about, you find that it just stops at the bail hearing and that there's no communication that exists between the state's attorneys that are looking at the bail decisions and the state's attorneys who ultimately get the case when it comes time for trial. So there's no kind of working together. And this is exactly the kind of thing I'm talking about that doesn't happen in the state's attorney's office today and hasn't for 15 years and needs to be more effective. And you can't say that it is working because I would hardly say that anyone would agree that a conviction rate of 35% means that the system is working. And that's what I would do differently.
Let's return to the phones here before we go to break and come back to more questions. 410-319-8888. Greg Bernstein's in the studio, who's running to become the next state's attorney for the city of Baltimore. Hank in Baltimore, you're on the air.
How are you doing, Mr. Bernstein? This is Steiner.
Welcome.
Welcome. This is something that bothers me, right? And I've recently been through the court system, right? Do you know that, like, on your charge, when you first go in for arraignment, right, most people have the option of choosing to take guilty and walk out of the courtroom. Just, I mean, like, okay, we locked you up. if you plead guilty, you don't have to see no probation officer, no parole officer, no nothing. Just admit the guilt, and we'll let you go, right? The average person takes that and not thinking, one, right, that, okay, I just put a felony on myself for maybe a bag of marijuana or something, right? And this young man no longer can actually hold down a legal job, right? Or he can't hold down a legal job, but he can't get one because he has that felony because he didn't think when he was coming up that one little, all right, I'll take this guilty and go home today instead of fighting it, really actually messed him over, right? Two, when fighting these cases, right, okay, if you lock a young man standing up on a corner with 10 bags, right, quite naturally, you know that those 10 bags aren't all that is, right? So once you get him, right, and you get the next person up, how far up the chain does it stop before you say, okay, I got enough people?
Those are two
really good questions.
I want to respond to them. Yeah, what is your first name, sir?
Hank.
Hank. I'm sorry, Hank. Hank, how are you? Let me try to answer both of them. And with respect to the first question, I think you've really hit upon what I feel is one of the major flaws in the way in which the state's attorney's office operates, and that is this, that they don't make the kinds of distinctions that Hank is talking about, in which they understand and push for convictions of offenders who commit these violent felonies and at the same time exercise discretion with one bag cases or possession of marijuana and provide alternatives that doesn't saddle you with a felony conviction. I mean, this is something, Mark, that I am very, very sensitive to. I mean, I know the impact that a felony conviction can have on a young person's life. I mean, I have this experience in my own family. And so I know the problem that happens when you get a felony conviction and the inability or the difficulty it is to get a job, to get education. It's really hard. And I think that what we need to do is, and Hank is right, we need to be strategic and make the right decisions about the cases we want to pursue and not just lump everybody together and saddle people with these felony convictions for these relatively small cases the way that Hank is describing. Now, as to his second question, I mean, Hank sounds like a good investigator or a good law enforcement officer because, of course, what you try to do, particularly in drug cases, is work your way up the chain. And I guess, Hank, my answer to your question is, as the state's attorney, I'll go up the chain as high as I can go, as high as the evidence will let me go, because ultimately you want to get to the major suppliers.
Well, Hank, I'm going to come back and follow up on your question after we take this brief break. And Leo, Victor, Thomas are the next three callers up, and we'll get to all of your questions for the top of the hour. We're talking with Greg Bernstein, Baltimore City State's attorney candidate. The number here is 410-319-8888. And as I said before we started the show, we hope this was going to be a debate. Pat Chesney is here on Monday, and we hope to have both of them back, Anthony McCarthy and I together, to have a real debate on the issues for all of you before September 14th on primary day. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. And I want to remind you that WEAA invites you to Jazz in the Sculpture Garden at the Baltimore Museum of Art this Saturday, August 21st at 7 p.m., featuring saxophonist Carl Grubbs, hosted by our very own Sandy Mallory. The Baltimore Museum of Art is located at 10 Art Museum Drive. For more information, you can call 443-573-1700 or go to artbma.org. Greg Bernstein is our guest. He is running to become the next state's attorney here in the city of Baltimore. Number here is 410-319-8888. Folks, I didn't say we were leaving. We were coming right back. We had like seven calls and just all disappeared. So come back now. 410-319-8888. Greg's not running out the door. He's going to answer your questions.
Well, clearly I've answered all their questions. And they don't need to hear any more from me.
To follow up on the last caller on Hank before we go to Leo. And what you were saying about the young men and women pleading guilty to these minor charges and getting a record and getting a job. This comes back to a question I asked you earlier, which has to do with who charges. One of the problems we have right now in the city is we do have thousands of people. Let's say maybe at least people have these stats all over the place. Let's say 2,000 to 4,000 people sitting in city jail and detention center are there for nonviolent crimes. They're there for minor crimes who can't get bail, who aren't offered bail or offered huge high bail they can't get. They're sitting there and they're charged with a thing from urinating in an alley to one bag of marijuana, whatever that happens to be in these nonviolent crimes. And it affects a lot of men and women who actually have jobs and lose them when they're inside those jails. So in that case, doesn't it make sense for the state's attorney to be there for charging, not leave it to a commissioner, not leave it to the police, for the state's attorney to be there to say, we're not going to prosecute this case this way, so this person doesn't sit in jail and then end up with – most of those cases never get to court anyway. I mean, so how would you change that? People do want the streets to be cleaned up of violent criminals, but I think people, especially in working-class communities in this town, are equally worried about the men and women in their families who languish in jail for no reason.
Right. Now, let me answer that question by approaching it a different way.
Go ahead.
And this is something I have given a lot of thought about. And I agree with one of your premises, which is that there are a lot of young men and women sitting in Baltimore City Jail languishing with high bails, but not even high bails, Mark, but low bails, like $1,000, $1,500, that they can't afford for these really small cases that are not nearly as serious as the ones that I'm talking about. And because the system is overburdened, to use your word, they languish for months on end and then wind up in court and take a plea and get a conviction for time served, quote unquote, for the time they've spent in jail. That's wrong. I am opposed to that. I think that we should try to work on a system where if someone is arrested for a relatively low offense case, one bag of heroin or a small amount of marijuana, and they don't have any violence in their history, setting a bail at $1,000 or $1,500 is not effective. And it's almost as if the system is using the bail system as a crutch, as a cop-out, as a way to get these individuals off the street and then wind up with a conviction. And that's, to me, that is not effective. So it's not a question, I would say to you, of the police arresting. Because if a police officer sees...
Police charging is what I'm saying. Charging.
Well, when a police officer arrests somebody, they charge them. And if they arrest somebody and charge them, I mean, they can't look the other way. I mean, it's important to them for quality of life purposes and to be in the community that if they see offense committed in their presence, they have to make the arrest. But I think that the way you approach that, okay, the way that you approach that is to say what then happens after that arrest is made. And if the offender is someone without violence in his or her past, and you have a commissioner that, for reasons I can't really fathom, is just going to set a $1,000 bail or a $500 bail that the person is never going to be able, you know, to make, then that's where I think it starts to break down. And that's, I think, what you change. You know, one last thing I would say, I'm sorry to monopolize the time, but one last thing
I
would say.
You're here for that.
Well, fair enough. But in the federal system, the federal statute provides that the magistrate judge cannot set, once the magistrate judge makes a determination that the defendant is not a danger to the to the community or risk of flight, he or she cannot set conditions of release that the defendant is unable to satisfy. So you can't just, what happens we see so often in the state system, just impose some high bail or even this low bail. I mean, that just doesn't work. And so that's what I would do.
Well, I'll come back to the follow-up, but let me go back to the phones, I promise. 410-319-8888. Leo in Bolton Hill, you're on the air.
Good evening, Mark.
Hi, Leo.
Good evening, Mr. Bernstein.
Good evening, Leo. Thanks for calling.
Well, I'm glad to hear from you. I have three areas of concern. I'm going to run through them rapidly that speak to police-community relations because I think it has a bearing on your campaign and the success or failure thereof. Number one, the police Baltimore City Police have a history of systemic institutional racism, a long history of that. $2.5 million judgment was awarded, settlement, four or five years ago with Officer Sergeant Hobson. I think you understand or remember that, with regard to the filing of racial discrimination charges by 12 Baltimore City black police officers against that police institution. The I might add that most of the police officers don't live in Baltimore City. Better than 90% of them live outside the city. I don't know whether that should be changed. I certainly hope there will be an effort to change it. The NAACP, my second point, NAACP and ACLU recently won a case regarding illegal arrests, thousands of illegal arrests under the Martin O'Malley administration when he was mayor. And we're glad to see that victory having been won. And my last point is that there's a perception that you solicited the current police commissioner, Bielefeld, to place your campaign signs on his lawn. Now, is that fact or fiction, and do you think that's ethical?
All right.
Do you think that's ethical conduct?
Right. Okay, Leo. So let me try to respond to all three of the points and the questions that you made. First of all, to the extent whether there is or is not systematic racism in the Baltimore City Police Department, I mean, I know the case to which you refer. Obviously, as the state's attorney, that's not something that I can control. I mean, what happens in the police department happens in the police department, and that's something that they have to work out among themselves. But I would say to that point that one of the main things I want to try to do when I become the state's attorney is to work more cooperatively with the police department in investigating and prosecuting these cases. And that would include participating in training programs for officers, new cadets, helping them to write reports, helping them to learn how to testify, helping them to be sensitive to some of the issues that you've described. None of these things go on in the current structure with the state's attorney's office. So I think that perhaps that might be one way to try to combat this point that you make. Secondly, on the illegal arrest case that you reference, I have said repeatedly, and I've said it on this show, and I'll say it again, that locking everybody up just does not work. I mean, not only does it not work because the arrests are suspect because of an absence of probable cause, but I think, Leo, what you're trying to say in part, and I agree with you, is that what it does is it establishes a terrible relationship between the community and the police. I mean, in the communities in which these arrests were being made, you see young men were just getting pulled up and arrested and thrown against the fence for no reason whatsoever in some cases. And that's why that lawsuit happened. And that policy has now changed from what happened under the O'Malley administration. And I'm just not in favor of it. And that's not something I certainly would encourage. And finally, to your question with respect to the police commissioner, the answer is simply no. I did not solicit him and I did not ask him to put the sign up on his front lawn.
Leo, thanks for your call. Let's go to Tommy in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Tommy. You're on the air.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate having this opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the new Republican candidate is up fighting an uphill battle, not from the standpoint of being a Republican. But
he's not a Republican. He's a Democrat.
Excuse me?
He is a Democrat.
Yeah, Tommy, this is Mr. Bernstein. I am a Democrat.
I mean, as a Democrat, you're fighting an uphill battle against your own party group. And you've raised a lot of money, so that should give you some advantage. But to get more at what I'm trying to arrive at, there are a number of things that's happened in Baltimore City, which I know that you're well aware. But when you hear the conversation from people who are running for your office, they talk about things like drugs, they talk about crime and things like that. And that, should be taken care of, and it should be at the top of your list. But there's a long-standing systemic cause to all these things, and that never seems to really be addressed. And it affects situations that wind up having the city to pay out large sums of money for things that the police do, but it never gets at the people that are behind the curtain pulling the strings. So one of my first questions to you is, are you willing to, if evidence is presented to you, understand, to go upstairs, to go behind the screen, to get at the people who are actually manipulating the system, to have the system so spread out over the Baltimore City that the advantages for the people who have done it and manipulated the system for so long is glaringly apparent? My third question to you, Sarah, is, based on your knowledge of the law, and I'm quite sure you're well-versed in it, you already know that the people have a right to go directly to the grand jury and provide some of the necessary evidence that's to be prosecuted. So I'm asking you directly, are you in favor of going to the grand jury on behalf of the citizens of Baltimore, or not hindering the citizens of Baltimore and going directly to the grand jury and not be impeded by the structure that's built in to frustrate the citizens from doing that?
All right.
Tell me,
we have a lot of callers, so let me ask you to finish up that last question so we can answer.
Go ahead.
You have one more question?
Yeah, I just want to say, I want to be assured that he's not going to hide behind the structure, the legal system, through the judges and the police that block everything to keep the people from walking in, just like the law says you have a right to walk in, right into the grand jury's office, after making an appointment, send a letter, and presenting your evidence without having the evidence being tampered with or shuffled around, let it go directly to
All
it,
right.
and have the grand jury go through their procedure of empowering people to review the evidence and having the citizens.
All right, Tommy. Let Greg Bernstein answer the questions.
Okay, thank you, Tommy. I mean, what I would say is
good questions.
Yes, Tommy. What I would say is that I do not approve and would not in any way countenance any kind of manipulation of the system by any agency or branch of government. It's something that we cannot allow happen. And certainly, if police officers or anybody tries to do something like that, you know, we would need to take appropriate action. With respect to the grand jury, Tommy, respectfully, I'm just going to have to disagree with you, and I would not be in favor of allowing citizens to just walk into the grand jury and present evidence of what they may believe to be a crime that may have been committed. I think that that would become a bit unwieldy in terms of allowing the state's attorneys to use the grand jury to investigate and prosecute cases. I would say finally, which is a little bit of a digression from Tommy's question, that one of the things that I think that the state's attorney's office does not do a very good job of is make use of the grand jury as part of their investigation. And we talk a lot about witness intimidation and witnesses' memories failing and not showing up for trial, which, frankly, I think in a lot of ways or a lot of times is the result of cases being continually postponed time after time after time. I mean, what do you expect a witness to do if they keep coming to court and only to be told that the case is to be postponed and then they don't get on the witness stand until 18 months later? But I think that one of the things that I will do as state's attorney in a strategic way with the cases that are involved these most violent offenders, in order to what we call, those of us who are trial lawyers and you know, do this kind of work, lock in their testimony, is to make use of the grand jury to lock in the witness's testimony so that you have it under oath. And then if issues arise later on about the witness, there are instances in which you can use it at trial.
So how do you stop trials from lasting, going 18 months to 2 years?
I think that the way that you do that is when it comes time for the trial date, you are prepared and you tell the judge that you are prepared and you are ready to go to trial. You don't accede, I'm not pronouncing the word right, to a defendant's lawyer's request for a postponement. I think too often state's attorneys allow defense lawyers to postpone cases or don't oppose a request for postponement because they have a lot of other cases on their docket, and it's just an easy way to kind of move that case aside and not have to worry about that one. But I think that if the state's attorney's office is more focused and acting strategically in saying, when I was talking before about the 500-600 bad guys out there, when you have that kind of case, because you can't do it every time. I recognize that. I mean, there's an overwhelming number of cases that the state's attorney's office has to prosecute. But And I'm not talking about doing it in every case, but when you're focused on the most violent offenders, the ones who keep going through this revolving door, as I've often said, that's the case where you show up in court on the trial date and say, "Judge, we're ready to go to trial. We're ready to go to trial." Now, will the judge always say, "Mr. Defense Lawyer, I'm sorry, the state's is ready, we're going to trial today"? No, because a lot of times the judge will say, "Well, the defendants asked for the postponement, we're going to give them a postponement." But if you keep doing that, then you start to build respect with the bench, something that doesn't really exist now in the Baltimore City State's Attorney's Office. They don't have the respect of the bench. And I think that if you start showing up prepared, saying, "We are ready to go," and it's not going to happen tomorrow, it'll take time, but you start to build a pattern and you build credibility, and then these cases start to go to trial more promptly.
Victor, you're on the air.
Going on, Mr. Bernstein?
Yes, sir, Victor. How are you?
All right. I actually hope you win, and hope you employ real changes within the Baltimore City State's Attorney's Office.
Thank you, sir.
I'm calling from Baltimore County, and this is regarding the stop snitching / culture of intimidation. As State's Attorney, what measures would you employ to keep witnesses protected? Because it's a culture here right now that is really, to me, it's the equivalent to a cancerous parasite. A video aired some years ago called Stop Snitching.
Right.
And there was a volume 2 to that as well. And it was perpetuated by entertainment, i.e. rappers and all sorts of people.
Right.
And I like to reference the Dawson family. You had a woman stand up against drug dealers, but then she and her family were subsequently killed as a result of her standing up.
Right.
As State's Attorney, what would you do to make things better for witnesses who are members of the grand jury who would like to come forward and, should I say, carry out their civic duties?
Right. And Victor, the answer to that question is as follows. I believe that the State's Attorney's Office currently and for some time now has not done an effective job in protecting witnesses who have witnessed a violent crime and who come to testify. And I think that what needs to be done to improve that is to not put witnesses in motels on the city-county line for a few nights while the trial's going on and say, "We've done our job. We've now protected the witness."
What do you do?
Here's what you do. You make places available for them to stay that are not in the city or on the city county line. You use other, surrounding counties that are far away. I mean, the other counties all have housing departments and have facilities available for these witnesses to stay in the appropriate case. Of course, you don't do it in every case, but in the more serious ones, you make funds available for them to stay for long periods of time if they have to. You talk about relocating them outside the city if necessary, even out of the state. And, of course, the question then becomes, where do you get the resources to do that? And there are several ways that you get those resources. You get those resources by being more judicious and strategic in how you use the resources that you have. Second, there's federal grant money that's not being competitively bid for by the State's Attorney's Office that you can go after and use. And then you also rely on the federal government to provide funding to assist in this kind of relocation that I'm talking about. The other thing that you do is you establish a better working relationship with the witnesses. You talk to them. You work with them. You don't just simply call them up the night before, the case, which is, of course, what happened in the Stephen Pekarin matter, where the person who, that's the poor Hopkins grad student, a research assistant who was murdered in Charles Village last month, where the individual who was involved in that murder, John Wagner, had the case back in April of this year where he had attacked and robbed somebody in a gas station. And when that case came up for a hearing, the state's attorney just simply called the victim and said, "Are you coming to court?" And the victim said, "No, I'm afraid." Didn't follow up, didn't send out the detective, didn't have the victim witness coordinator call. And I think that, Victor, to further respond to your question, if you say in these really serious cases, the ones where you've got these violent offenders, that we are going to go the extra mile and we're going to make sure these witnesses are protected. And more importantly, we're going to be talking to them early on and find out if there are any issues. And we're going to have the detectives meet with them. We're going to bring them in. And that's how I think you start to combat it. It's not an easy issue to resolve, but I think that's one way you improve.
Para, you're on the air.
Thank you, Mark, and hello, Greg. you started to get at this a little earlier before, and if you've said more at the top of the show, I'm afraid I didn't join until a half hour into the show, but talking about working more cooperatively with the police department, one thing that Ms. Jessamy has said repeatedly in her defense of your criticism of her record is that, you know, she can only take the cases that are brought to her, and that she is, the state attorney's office is reliant on the evidence and the investigation that is done by the police department. Can you talk a little bit more? You seem to have already developed a good rapport with Commissioner Bielefeld. Can you say a little bit more about how you intend to collaborate with the police department to ensure that the evidence that they're able to gather and bring to the state's attorney's office to help prosecute the case is going to be the kind of admissible evidence that the state's attorney's office is going to need to go after these guys, to go after them quickly, and make sure that you get a good conviction?
Yes. Is it Tara?
Para.
Para. I'm sorry, Para. Para. Yes. Let me respond to your question. And let me respond initially by way of an illustration. Several weeks ago, the city council conducted a hearing in which they asked the state's attorney to come and the police commissioner to come to talk about the audit that's being conducted of the unfounded rape cases that we've all heard about.
Right.
And excuse me 1 minute, I have to take a sip of water. And they're conducting an audit to find out why the police have found so many rape cases to be unfounded. Obviously, that's a very serious problem. Now, the state's attorney, Ms. Jessamy, came to the hearing, and the statement that she read was that we can, to paraphrase what you said, this was her statement, was that we only can prosecute the cases that are brought to us by the police. And in essence, what she was saying was, if you don't bring us the case, we can't prosecute it. Therefore, we don't know anything at all about these unfounded cases because the police found them to be unfounded, and therefore it's not our problem, which, of course, is how her office has responded to many instances in which questions have arisen about how investigations have been conducted, i.e. not our problem, it's the police problem. Nothing about these are unique cases, these are unique victims. We need to work more closely with the police and help train them to learn how better techniques to interview these witnesses to be so that the victims feel more comfortable. Nothing about, because these cases are unique, we need to be involved early on in the investigations, working with the officers to develop the evidence. Nothing. And to me, I thought it was, because I was at the hearing watching, to me, I thought it was just very telling because it really shows the kind of thing that I'm talking about. If you have state's attorneys, Para, who are working with the officers in the beginning stages of the cases, you can't do it every time, but if working in the beginning stages of the cases, you're going to have more effective presentation. The one last thing I'll say is that
30 seconds.
One last thing I would say is a great example of this is in homicide cases. I mean, why can't you have a state's attorney involved in that investigation from the beginning, helping the detective develop the evidence so that you can make a more effective presentation?
Greg Bernstein has been our guest. He's running to become the next state's attorney for the city of Baltimore. Pat Jessamy may be here Monday, and Anthony McCarthy and I are looking forward to having a debate between the two before September 14th right here on WEAA. And Greg Bernstein, thank you so much for talking to the listeners today.
Thank you.
I want to remind you, coming up in the next hour, we're going to have an interview with Paul Greenberg, author of Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food. You can catch Paul in person tonight, by the way, at 6:30 this evening at Enoch Pratt Southeast Anchor Library at 3601 Eastern Avenue. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. It's a simple way to stay connected to the topics and events you care about most. Daily content on arts, culture, food design, style, green living, and much more can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com. Stay with us. We'll be right back.